we tightened up the process, and in the end, the veterans get to use their benefits.
A solution breaks an impasse between the state and federal governments. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 13th of November. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, an overlooked component in the debate over climate change.
There's actually very little consideration of human rights of Indigenous peoples or any other peoples.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world.
The Pioneer Homes administrators and nurses have found a way to let veterans who reside at the state-owned assisted living facilities receive the free medicine to which they have a right. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The problem first arose in April when it was discovered that veterans were having to pay for prescription medicine from the Pioneer Homes, although they were entitled to that medicine at no charge from the federal government. The issue was over the home's dosing requirement that did not allow nurses to use medicine sent to them in bulk. The state requirement was based on safety issues. The state has now rewritten its safety protocols, setting requirements for nurses to follow in administering the prescriptions. Pioneer Homes Director David Cote says nurses and direct care staff assisted in putting the policy together.
Policy and procedure, which is basically a step-by-step instructions of what we do, from how do we get medications ordered to what do we do with the medications when they come into the home, to storing them, to administering them, to disposing of them. So we went through all aspects of dealing with Veteran Administration medications and basically formalized a policy so that all nurses in all of the homes, should this spread to other homes, would know how this should be handled and to be doing it safely.
Cody says there's no additional expense for handling the medication. Nurses, not certified aides, will administer it because of their higher degree of medical experience. He says they're healthcare professionals who are good at their profession. For its part, the VA agreed to communicate better its instructions and information on the medicines.
We wanted to work with the VA to make sure that veteran residents could use their VA benefits and to be able to use them, and in this case, obtain medications and have it administered in the safest way possible. So I think we tightened up the process, and in the end, the veterans get to use their benefits.
Anchorage Senator Bill Willikowski was one of those legislators who originally brought the problem forward. He says it's a good solution that gives the residents back the services they've had in place before.
You had a big clash between the state bureaucracy and the federal bureaucracy, and it's two pretty immovable objects. And fortunately, I think on the state level, we were able to be a little bit more nimble and simply go back to the system that we had in place and get our bureaucracy more in line with what the feds are doing. So it's a good solution.
Cody says those veterans who have been paying the Pioneer Homes for their VA medication will be held harmless. He says they will receive a full refund for the medical charges they've incurred. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The Federal Aviation Administration is beefing up the air traffic control staff at Fairbanks International Airport. The number of controllers at Fairbanks has been below standard and has resulted in some nighttime operations being turned over to Anchorage. FAA spokesman Mike Fergus says a mix of seasoned and new controllers are bringing the operation back to full service capacity.
And where we stand right now is we are authorized 20 to 24 controllers. We have three more coming on board that will be partially qualified. They'll be academy grads, and we call them developmental. They'll be coming on board November to January sometime in that time frame, and we expect some more then within the next 12 months after that.
Fairbanks isn't the only airport where there's been a shortage of air traffic controllers in recent years. National Air Traffic Controllers Association Alaska Region President Larry Leskanek says Bush administration-era cuts reduced staffing nationwide with the goal of eventual privatization. He says that's been reversing itself since Democrats took control of Congress, but that some stations, like Fairbanks, still have trouble retaining people.
Fairbanks suffers from another problem in that a lot of people that have gone up there have complained about the isolation and the climate, so they don't want to stay there. So they have real difficulty retaining people just because of the location and the climate to start with, even before we had any problems with the FAA with hiring.
Leskanek's union represents about 350 air traffic controllers and associated employees at 20 airports across Alaska. Leskanek says the new hires at Fairbanks will bring the station back to full operating capacity, but that, like many control sites nationwide, the FAA is relying heavily on less experienced controllers.
Looks like they have 7 trainees right now in the building, so within a few months here, they're going to have almost as many trainees as they do journeyman controllers, and that's pretty common throughout the system now.
Leskanek says many of the most seasoned air traffic controllers date from hiring that followed a 1981 strike, and their service is timing out. Federal regulations require air traffic controller applicants to be 30 years old or younger, and they have to retire after 25 years. Leskanek says the shortage of controllers is also affecting FAA flight service stations at Bush airports.
Rural communities where we don't have control towers, but we have airports, and we have the flight service option basically serves pilots with weather and real-time airport information and flight plan filing and tracking. And the FAA has let that staffing go so low for so long that it's becoming a problem now.
Leskanek says a new generation of controllers is coming up. A University of Alaska Anchorage training program is one of 2 dozen such schools that offer 2 to 4 year air traffic controller education programs, which qualify graduates for FAA jobs. ADAC may eventually be home to a new massive gas-powered gun used for launching things into space. The new technology is being developed by physicist John Hunter and his colleagues at Quick Launch Incorporated. Hunter spoke with KUCB's Ann Hillman in Unalaska.
The idea is to use the cannon-like mechanism to fire large payloads of cargo, like propellant and building materials, into space for a fraction of the current cost. It would be about $250 per pound instead of $5,000 per pound. Hunter says this will help make long-distance travel, like a manned mission to Mars, feasible.
At the current launch costs, we will never get a substantial manned mission to Mars. We just can't afford it.
They can also shoot up satellites much faster and on shorter notice than a rocket system, which could help the Department of Defense and other organizations. The idea for the launcher is based on an old sci-fi novel.
What we've taken is the Jules Verne concept. You know, he wrote a book called From the Earth to the Moon, where they were going to use gunpowder to launch people to the moon, which is a little bit far out. And so instead of launching people, we're going to be launching propellant and rugged things.
The cannon is basically a large, long tube with a bottle of high-temperature compressed hydrogen at the bottom that will be pointed at a space depot. It fires and shoots the cargo into space.
Essentially a big pop gun.
Along the way, the cargo drops a recoverable, recyclable aeroshell that protects it from the heat as it speeds through the atmosphere. Hunter says that overall, the system creates only about 10% as much debris as the conventional rocket system. Hunter and his colleagues started looking at building their first commercial-scale payload launcher in ADAC back in 2001, but they became involved with defense projects in Iraq instead. Now they're back at it. He says ADAC is the ideal location for a ground launcher because it's at the same latitude as the International Space Station. That way, they can easily use the space station as their space depot. The island is also isolated and far from large population centers and has a good hill to launch from that's about 9 miles north of the small town. Because the cannon will shoot due east, it will not affect ADAC, but it might affect the citizens of Atka.
Every time we do a launch, we would have that. Those guys would have to go into a shelter for a few minutes, or you know, just to be on the safe side. But the odds of anything coming down there are very, very slim.
He says they will also make sure the ocean area near the launch is clear of ships before firing. Hunter says the notoriously bad weather at Adak, the so-called birthplace of the winds, will not hamper the project.
The wind is not an issue at all. Okay, these things are coming out of the barrel at around Mach 20. So a Mach 0.01 wind is not going to be an issue. The sideways rain, if we do have rain, more than likely the system will stand down because you don't want to fly through rain with these at these high speeds, because at that speed the rain acts like steel babies and can cause major problems to the vehicle.
Hunter says the ADAC system would ideally be built in the next 5 years to launch payloads of 100 pounds. After that, they would develop an ocean-based system that can launch 1,000-pound payloads in any direction and be more versatile. The land-based system will cost about $50 million, and the ocean-based system will run about $500 million. Quick Launch Inc. is still seeking some financial backers and has not yet spoken with current Aleut Corporation leaders about building on their land on Adak Island. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how do you live to be 101 years old?
Everybody wants to know that, and sometimes I don't think he knows.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And by AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com.
Sixth graders Megan and Illa are singing a song about salmon in their Atna Athabaskan dialect. But some Alaska Native leaders fear that the salmon and the Alaska Native way of life may disappear by the time the girls grow up. Andrea Carman is executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council, which has fought for Native rights since 1974.
And was actually the first Indigenous organization to get what's called consultative status with the United Nations Economic and Social Council. So we've been working for recognition of Indigenous peoples' human rights, including land rights, treaty rights, subsistence rights.
Carmen's group hosted a workshop in Anchorage Friday to hear from Alaskans regarding the local impacts of climate change.
I just got back from Barcelona and finding, sad to say, among the governments of the world discussing solutions to climate change, there's actually very little consideration of human rights of Indigenous peoples or any other peoples.
Carmen says human rights and climate change are linked.
The causes of climate change are directly impacting Indigenous peoples' human rights, our food sovereignty and right to food, our right to not be forcibly relocated, our right to free, prior, and informed consent, which all of these are rights that are in international law but are especially recognized for Indigenous peoples in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
Food is a basic human right, and Vi of Savunga says climate warming has only increased levels of pollution found in the Arctic, even affecting the whales that her villagers depend on.
We have a right to know about these toxic chemicals from the military legacy, and also these chemicals, persistent organic pollutants that trespass into our environment and ending up in our traditional foods.
Carmen says Indigenous peoples noted environmental changes long before Western scientists took the matter seriously.
But we're seeing corn not growing anymore in our desert communities. We're seeing fish decrease. I gave an example of one river in British Columbia where the fish return, sockeye, had decreased from 700,000 to 100,000 in a matter of just a few years. And the scientists came in to confirm what Indigenous peoples already were saying, is that it was caused by a half a degree temperature rise in the river temperature, and salmon being an indicator species are very sensitive to any environmental changes.
She says on an international level, discussions of eco-migrants or climate refugees are already starting, and that climate change is in reality a climate crisis, and it needs to be addressed by all peoples finding solutions on a local level.
I think our grandchildren are due no less from us.
The federal government is spending less this year to help sell Alaska seafood overseas. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The U.S. Agriculture Department just announced it's giving the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute about $4.7 million. That's almost $500,000 less than last year. ASME spokeswoman Laura Fleming says it's within the range of recent years' appropriations, but she says the dollar's low value is causing bigger problems.
What we're looking at is trying to do as much as we can overseas in our marketing programs in China, in Japan, and the European Union with a dollar that converts to, you know, euros or to yen or to yuan and doesn't buy as much as it did a couple of years ago.
She says cuts will be made across the board rather than to a single marketing program. There's also a chance additional federal funds will be made available later. ASME plans to spend about $6.5 million marketing seafood overseas this year. Funding also comes from the state and the industry. Fleming says the institute is changing its focus in some nations, such as China.
It used to be that China was mainly considered a reprocessing center for our industry, but now they're economy is strengthening, their middle class is growing, and more of that Alaska seafood is staying in the country.
She says the institute recently completed its first China trade mission that focused on domestic demand. The trip included visits to groceries, high-end hotel restaurants, and quick-service stores.
We've sent Alaska chefs over to China to teach seafood buyers from the retail stores, to teach culinary students how to prepare frozen Alaska seafood. And the extent to which the market is educated about Alaska seafood determines where we spend our dollars.
International marketing efforts include about 20 countries. Japan remains the largest overseas seafood buyer. Fleming says Alaska exported about $1.6 billion worth of seafood to targeted nations last year. Sales rose about 10% there, while increasing only about 3% in other countries.
The whole purpose of what we do is to raise the value of that harvest. And part of the way we do that is through branding. The Alaska seafood brand has achieved a certain amount of brand penetration and brand recognition in our key overseas markets, and most of our seafood goes to those international markets.
ASME is one of 70 U.S. trade organizations getting a total of $235 million in federal overseas marketing funds this year. They range from the National Hay Association to the Popcorn Board and the Wine Institute. ASME's total budget this year, including domestic marketing, is about $15 million. I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Police training taking place at the University of Alaska Fairbanks this week includes simulated violence. UAF Police Chief Sean McGee says the on-campus drills are aimed at playing out a shooting incident.
A lot of times you'll hear the term active shooter, and it deals specifically with trying to prepare the officers and our community here at UAF so that they could respond to this type of event on campus.
McGee says the training has been scheduled for some time and is not specifically in response to last week's mass shooting at Fort Hood in Texas.
We've been doing this type of training now for probably around the last 6 or 7 years. This particular event, we've been planning this for about the last 6 months, and unfortunately, as recent times have indicated, it's necessary training. We've learned that it doesn't have to be a high school or a grade school where these types of events take place. It could take place just about anywhere. And so this is certainly an effort by Fairbanks law enforcement to better prepare themselves to respond to these types of events.
About 15 officers from local law enforcement as well as role players are participating in the three-day training.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. People are either sighted or blind, right? Wrong. Many eye conditions can lead to low vision. People with low vision have some sight, but even with glasses, they may still have trouble doing things they're used to. A low vision assessment helps people identify special tools and skills to live on their own independently and succeed at work. Learn more at 248-7770 or alaskabvi.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, with support from Lions Clubs.
Sea Alaska hopes a new tribal energy organization will play a significant role in the development of federal energy policies. The Southeast Regional Native Corporation is part of the Indian Country Renewable Energy Consortium, a nationwide group. Sea Alaska CEO Chris McNeil says the consortium, formed earlier this year, is pushing for inclusion in renewable and green energy legislation.
We want to be a thought on the first day rather than an afterthought, going out the door as some legislation is being written. So we're bearing down on that from an analysis standpoint as well. And we, if there is legislation, we want to be part of it.
The consortium wants a number of changes, making it easier for tribal groups to develop their energy resources. That includes a streamlined permitting system. McNeil says Sea Alaska is pushing to include hydropower as a renewable energy source, and he wants more federal assistance for tidal power technology.
It seems to us that it's something that we ought to be able to evaluate, because these are issues that could very well stimulate our village economies and the region. And so it's one of the things that we want to be sure we've, you know, again, we're at the table as for the potential of it.
The Native Energy Consortium is also calling for more tribal involvement in wind, solar, and biomass projects. Most are expected to be developed on lower 48 reservations. The Reverend Dr. Walter Soboleff will be 101 years old tomorrow, but no community parties are planned this year. The renowned Tlingit elder and Presbyterian minister is on a cruise to celebrate. Parties were held for his 98th, 99th, and 100th birthday. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander takes a look back at his life with Son Ross and through a few of Dr. Soboleff's speeches, interviews, and services over the years.
Our Father God, no one has ever seen you. Then we look at the stars, we look at the sun and the moon.
69 years after his ordination, the Reverend Dr. Walter Soboleff is still tending his flock, wherever they may be. He serves in the pulpit, officiates at weddings, memorials, baptisms, and special functions. He lives on his own. He would tell you he's getting along just fine. And if you ask him the key to his longevity,
everybody wants to know that, and sometimes I don't think he knows.
At 58, Son Ross is the youngest of Walter and Genevieve's four children, all who live in Juneau. He's not one of the family members on that celebratory cruise through the Panama Canal.
It's something he's wanted to do for a long time. He has always loved the big ships and the ocean.
Walter Soboleff was born into a Tlingit family in the community of Killisnoo on Admiralty Island on November 14, 1908. Killisnoo no longer exists, nor the Russian orphanage and Sheldon Jackson School in Sitka that he attended. The Juneau Memorial Presbyterian Church he served for 22 years is closed and has merged with another. The Presbyterian governing body sold the mission boats that took his ministry to Southeast Native villages, logging camps, and Coast Guard lighthouses. The lighthouses are no longer manned. He's bridged more than a century of technological changes, as well as cultural, economic, and political transitions.
He's always been, at his core, a spiritual man, a scholar, a man who is seeking knowledge.
Ross admits growing up as a preacher's kid has its challenges.
Speaking just strictly personally and selfishly, you have to share your paw with the rest of the world.
The Soboleffs' home was always open to the congregation, the community, and out-of-towners, As a boy, Walter Jr. says he loved those days.
During the gold medal ball tournament, our place would just fill up with players. Or if there was a church event in town like Presbytery, all the choir members would come over the house. We'd go caroling Christmas Eve with the whole church congregation. It was great.
And the house on 10th Street always had room for more kids. Dr. Sobolev likes to tell the story about cowboys and Indians.
The little boys and girls in this neighborhood, I don't know who taught them how to play Indians and cowboys. And of course, my little boys were the Indians, and they were always beating the cowboys. And the cowboys finally said, "Let's be the Indians and you be the cowboys."
He and my mom liked to go on Sunday drives, and it was in May, and they took a drive down by Harris Boat Harbor. And there was a couple of young kids that were standing there. And when they came back later in the evening, those same kids were there. So they stopped to see who they are and why they were there. Well, the boat from Sheldon Jackson had dropped them off in town at the end of the school year, and there was nobody there to get them. And so they said, "Well, come on and stay with us." And they did for that whole summer. My parents did that again and again and again.
Those kids were from Haines. And as adults, they're still in contact with Dr. Sobolev. And he's still giving advice to youth. A year ago, at 100, he addressed the teenagers at the Alaska Federation of Natives.
I was in the first grade, and the teacher said, take care of the old person you're going to become. And I thought, what a funny talk to give us. But I never forgot it. It was one of the best messages I ever heard. Take care of the old person you're going to become. Here I am. Young people, you must take better care of yourself. Take better care of yourself. The world needs your leadership. Your people need your leadership. Can we depend on you?
The Reverend Dr. Walter Sobolev, 101 years old. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bras in Fairbanks and Hillman in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the new AT&T, your world delivered,
and by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. People are either sighted or blind, right? Wrong. Many eye conditions can lead to low vision, and people with low vision have some sight, but even with glasses, they may still have trouble doing things they're used to. A low vision assessment helps people identify special tools and skills to live on their own independently and succeed at work. Learn more at 248-7770 or alaskabvi.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired with support from Lions Clubs.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.